Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over the God's green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the Divine Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger, David Burns, and the Rivertown Kids on the wonderful Tomorrow's Children album, Grammy Award-winning Tomorrow's Children Hour. And album, we're back for another hour here with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Got a great guest today, Kevin Zeese, the better half of Margaret Flowers, who was with us last week. We're going to talk again about Fukushima, about the TPP, the toilet paper agreement, and the Occupy movement, and much, much more. Kevin, it's a pleasure to have you on. Kevin, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, very good. Okay. It's a pleasure to have you on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm glad to be with you. We're going to talk about marijuana today, too. I know you've been very active with the marijuana issue, but let's start first with the obligatory talk about Fukushima, get that out of the way. I read a piece today. It's not often I get thrown for a tizzy, but I read a piece today. I couldn't bear to post it at nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org, where we post. I've been posting articles, links to articles about Fukushima for the last 2.5 years and about nuclear power in general since 2007. I want to mention, too, by the way, we do have a petition at nukefree.org calling for global intervention and a takeover at Fukushima. We're getting all these assurances now from the Japanese that they're calling for international attention. I'm sure it's because of our petition, and they want to have the world cooperate, but the crisis at Fukushima is still being managed, and I use that term loosely, by Tokyo Electric Power Company, a private corporation whose liability is protected under the law. There's an amusing story in today's New York Times, actually, about India and negotiating a nuclear deal with India. Indian government does not want to give the American nuclear companies, General Electric and Westinghouse, primarily, total protection from liability in case of a major disaster. They did have a small problem called Bhopal in India, where 10,000 people died, and the company Union Carbide has not been held responsible. The president or leader of Union Carbide lives in the United States and has dared not set foot in India since the accident. So the Indian government wants to make sure that if U.S. companies build reactors in India, they at least have some liability, and the Americans don't want to agree to this at all. It's in the New York Times today, and I posted it at nukefree.org, a fascinating article. At any rate, we do have a petition circulating. Kevin knows all about it. We'll talk about it in a bit, calling for global takeover at Fukushima. And last night around 11 p.m., we went over the 100,000 mark. We have had more than 100,000 signatories to our petition calling for global takeover at Fukushima. It was fun. I watched it like watching the odometer on my old car, my 1991 Volvo, which went over 135,000 yesterday. I watched that one go too. So at any rate, I did read this article today, and Kevin, if you'll forgive me, I'm going to go on a little bit about this. A sailor put up a blog about the dead zone in the Pacific Ocean. And he said, basically, you know, this is one of these anecdotal things, but pretty convincing. He wrote about how he's out sailing on the Pacific and went for several thousand miles without seeing anything alive. No dolphins, no whales, no... Well, he saw a whale with a giant tumor on it, and that the whole Pacific is essentially turning into a dead zone. I'm familiar with dead zones. I live in central Ohio. I ride my bike all over the place. I'm continually going over small creeks and streams, and I look down at these creeks and streams, and there is nothing. No fish, no birds, no turtles, no snakes. And you know, when the Indians were here before the white men came, white men and women came, you couldn't see the bottom of these creeks and streams because there were too many fish. And today there are none. It's a remarkable moment when you see a big fish in, or fish of any kind in these streams. And, this guy, on this blog, I guess I'll have to post it, the link at nukefree.org. I just couldn't bring myself to do it today. Is talking about the whole Pacific being a dead zone. We can, of course, add the Gulf of Mexico to that. You know, sometimes you do this work and, it does get to you. Kevin, you've been an activist for decades. Tell me about a moment when it really got to you.
Oh, well, it actually got me early on. My first work was when I was in law school, and actually the first day-to-day work. I was an activist on other issues before that, but when I was in law school, I was working in Normal. My first jobs were reading
letters. Normal being the national organization for the
marijuana laws. And I was, my job was responding
legalization
to
marijuana,
letters
right?
from prisoners and prisoner families. And so those were all pretty, you'd read letter after letter from people in those situations, and it gets to you. It really does. And I think, your reaction to the ocean story, our oceans are in such deep trouble. And, Margaret and I just this weekend were writing an article on Fukushima based on our conversation with you on our radio show last week. And when we do those articles, we do additional research on the issue. And, boy, it was like every time you look at more information, it just is worse and worse and worse. It's amazing this is not being covered every day on the front page of the New York Times. This is a catastrophe that unmeasurable, the potential damage, and the Pacific Ocean is one big part of that catastrophe, with the amount of toxic radiated water going into the Pacific on a daily basis, and the potential for some of those rickety tanks that are holding so much, even more radiation. It's just mind-boggling, and the aquifers underneath Fukushima can even affect Tokyo. It's just amazing the breadth of the catastrophe, and to see it not discussed and not being on the news every night, people not being aware of it. I mean, this is something that can literally affect every person on the planet. I mean, really, you're talking about the biggest ocean on the planet, the Pacific, basically being unfishable. You're talking about clouds of radiation spreading around and around the globe. I mean, it's just amazing this is not being discussed regularly, and that an international crisis isn't focusing on it. It's just we're more focused on the stupidity of Obamacare and its technological inability to deal with the complex insurance industry. That's bad enough because it affects lots of people's lives in the United States. We're talking about something that affects billions.
Yeah, and not only is it not being covered, but the opposite is given space. The Times ran today an abominable piece of garbage written by a guy named David Ropeek, who I actually met in Boston many, many years ago. He was a reporter covering for a local TV station covering the Clamshell Alliance when we were demonstrating at Seabrook. And the theme of the article is that it's just not as bad as you think it is, and radiation is really no big deal. And, it's all a scare. And the article, scientifically and in journalistic terms, is just utter crap. I mean, it's just, completely unfounded, hearsay, dismissive stuff based on no evidence whatsoever, quite the contrary.
Yeah.
And the Times prints this stuff. And although the Times, I think the Times management is very ambivalent about nuclear power. They printed a reasonable editorial the other day about the politics of Fukushima. I'll admit here, I sent them a piece about Fukushima 4, and let's just see if they run it. But this thing actually was almost as depressing as the reports from the dead zone in the Pacific.
Is it a reporter or a columnist?
Well, he's been a reporter, and it's an op-ed. He has a book out, a whole book out, about talking about how things just aren't as bad as we think. And that, you know, radiation just hasn't had the impact. You know, Godzilla has not arisen from the mud. And there was one astonishing sentence just absolutely blew me away. He was talking about cancer patients and people who died. He said there was a study of some 10,000 people who died of cancer, and they came to the conclusion that only 500 of them had died from cancers caused by radiation. I mean, what kind of sickness is that? What if you were, or your child was one of those 500? 500 of 10,000 is a pretty significant number. And, you know, this guy is just dismissing the killing power of radiation, doesn't mention any scientific studies. On the other side, it's an abomination.
I mean, I look at the World Health Organization and the IAEA, and they're reporting on the impact of radiation and on the impact of Fukushima. It's so understating the stuff, and they're drawing conclusions at this early stage, as you know, when so much risk. I mean, we article, by the way, is coming out on Truth Now on Wednesday, and I think you'll really appreciate it, Harvey.
Thank you.
We looked at the Fukushima as three major problems. One was the obviously the water problem. You know, is one that has so many different permutations to it. The three missing cores and the potential impact of that on aquifers and you know, heat causing steam into clouds of radiation. And of course, the rods, you know, the spent fuel rods, which is the really scary. Each one of those three has never happened before, and has their own incredible risks with it. And none of them have very good solutions. We just haven't figured them out yet.
No, nothing we know about is solving it. Just Kevin, just to jump in, you mentioned water first. There was a typhoon that hit Japan over the weekend. And they have admitted now that the typhoon caused overflows on the dams and dumped still more radioactive water from Fukushima into the ocean. I mean, you know, it just doesn't end.
And we just barely missed, bigger damage with that storm. And thankfully, it didn't, you know, kind of braze the coast there. It didn't really hit Fukushima directly. But the risks in that area of earthquakes and typhoons and storms, when we were writing the article, we were wondering, you know, does TEPCO, does Japan, does the United States, the UN not want to get involved in trying to clean this up? Because they know if they get involved, it's a very high-risk fix. There's no easy solutions to these problems, and they could cause a lot of damage in trying to fix it. Would they rather wait for the earthquake, you know, or the typhoon to hit? And blame it on the earthquake and typhoon rather than take the responsibility themselves. Is that what's going on here? Are they trying to avoid responsibility?
It's possible. And, you know, I looked at this stuff. You know, that's what I do is look at this stuff. And I looked at a video today, a really reasonable report, actually, in depth on the upcoming removal of the fuel from Fukushima 4. And you had a somewhat contrite official from Japan and talking and, you know, assuring us that great preparations have been made. And of course, he slipped in the fact that the TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, is still in charge. Now, you know,
God, that was one thing that really blew me away in preparing this article, was reading about TEPCO. I can't believe they cut the employee's salary, you know, in 2011 by 20% to save money. These employees are in a state of shock, dealing with crises every day, and you cut their salary to cut corners? It's crazy.
Yeah, well, it's corporate. I mean, you know, the bottom line is you have a for-profit corporation.
That's right.
That's in charge of dealing with a crisis that affects all of humankind, and they are still looking at the bottom line. They're going to be cutting corners. The lowest bidder is going to be removing the fuel from Fukushima 4. Because they're still concerned about their quarterly profits.
That's
you know,
incredible.
This can't happen. This is the reason for our petition to get the world to take over at Fukushima. I keep hearing people, oh, you can't say that. It's going to be an affront to Japanese sovereignty. They're
proud people.
I mean, come on. This is the world at stake here.
Let's not worry about Japanese sovereignty when the whole globe is at stake. Come on, wake up. Put your priorities in order.
It's terrifying.
As we were working through it, is that, you know, a lot of what the problem is facing reality. There's just not a willingness to face a reality. And a lot of that reality is pretty negative when you look at Fukushima and you look at TEPCO and the lies that the regulators have been telling people and the lies of WHO and the IAEA. But there's also some positive facing reality that we can do at this stage. I mean, it's been true to many of us for a while, but it's now, I think, not beyond dispute by anybody. We can create a carbon-free, nuclear-free energy economy. The technology is there right now, and it's advancing quickly and getting better all the time. And if there was an effort by the United States, by a more global effort, to create a carbon-free, nuclear-free energy economy, it could just be amazing. And so my hope, of course, is that we face up to Fukushima, face reality, an international group comes in and finds the challenging solutions to the various difficult problems they face. And I think there will be solutions if there is, but we got to act quickly. I just, the earthquake typhoon zone makes me very nervous, and that's beyond our control. But, if we face up to the problems of Fukushima, minimize the risk, but then also recognize that it's time for a carbon-free, nuclear-free energy economy. And it was interesting for us to be writing this article this weekend because also up in Canada, you're having these conflicts over fracking on First Nations land, where the Royal Canadian Mounted Police are coming with hundreds of troops and sharpshooters and SWAT teams to attack a nonviolent blockade of a hydrofracking effort on native land. And so, this conflict about that we're going through right now with the old energy sources that are getting more and more extreme in their extraction and are getting riskier. I mean, we saw an article that in the tar sands in Alberta, 90% of the energy of the tar sands are too deep to dig out. And so they're planning on putting small nuclear plants on top to create steam they can frack into the ground to force the tar sands up. I mean, give me a break. Are you nuts?
They are nuts.
Tar sands and nuclear?
Yeah, they're completely nuts. We're talking with Kevin Zeese. Kevin is a lifelong activist, and Kevin is one of those guys who has a resume that's too long. He's one of the great activists in this country. His resume is too long for me to try and even begin to summarize. So, Kevin, tell our listeners, please, how you'd like to be identified, what you'd like our listeners to know about you, and what your best website is right now.
Yeah, the best website for us is popularresistance.org. And Popular Resistance is a website that kind of grew out of our reflections from our experience in the Occupy movement, as well as our work in other areas. And we, as the Occupy encampments ran down, we were trying to figure out where to go next. We started to talk to lots of activists who were involved in Occupy, activists who were involved in other issues, got some meetings with various groups of activists from different issues, different geography, different racial and ethnic backgrounds, to try to get a sense of how do we get the movement to the next level. And popularresistance.org really is that effort. It's not only a website that provides news every day, 15 to 20 articles about what's going on in the United States and around the world, but also provides strategy and tactical advice, getting people, really good people, thinking about those issues and sharing those ideas. And it also gets involved in campaigns. We have a campaign on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, trying to stop that corporate coup, global corporate coup, and also, of course, we're joining you on the Fukushima effort to try to get this global problem solved with a global solution and really a takeover by the best people in the world to solve this very catastrophic potential problem. So we do campaigns, we do news, we have a daily news summary, which is a great daily news summary. I mean, if you want to get a quick way to, every day to be on top of what's happening in the movement, it's a beautiful way to start the day. It goes out 7:30 Eastern time every morning, and we also do a weekly news summary. Now, we don't cover every news story of the week in that summary because there's about 120, 150 articles each week. What we do is we look at trends the big issues of the week and lessons you can learn from that week's activities. And so we do a weekly news summary as well, so you can sign up for that there too. So that's
the website again is
our work together, popularresistance.org.
All right, very good. Kevin Zeese, now. Just to wrap up on Fukushima, and then we want to move on to happier topics like, say, cannabis. It's really become clear that the people in charge there have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I don't know how we're going to wrest control, W-R-E-S-T, control of the situation from TEPCO and ultimately from the Japanese. But we need cameras there. We need the whole world watching. Next month, TEPCO allegedly, apparently, is going to try and start to remove the some 1,500-plus fuel rods from the Unit 4 fuel pool, which is 100 feet in the air. Brilliant design from General Electric. And this is something that everybody's got to be hyper aware. God forbid they should drop one of these rods. It's got to be done manually now. I mean, the crane has to be controlled manually, not by computer. There is debris in the pool. Salt water was poured into the pool. Fuel rods are crumbling. God forbid they should screw this up. And I'm told I had an email conversation with Arnie Gunderson today, the great engineer from Vermont who's been so crucial to our awareness about Fukushima. And he says, just what I wanted to hear today, he said that the things are worse at Unit 3 than they are at Unit 4. I hesitated to ask why, but so we have a long, long road to haul here with Fukushima. Kevin Zeese,
so
let's just hope we can get out of it somehow.
He's worried about Unit 3?
Yeah. He said that the situation in Unit 3 was worse than Unit 4. I couldn't even bear to ask him why.
Oh,
so, at any rate, as we know, there have been three meltdowns at Fukushima, bringing it a total of five. So at Three Mile Island melted, although they denied it for 9 years. Chernobyl exploded, and now we've had three melted Fukushima. There is a disturbing escalation in the severity of these accidents. And, the estimate at Fukushima is that the fuel rods in Unit 4 alone contain 14,000 times the cesium that was released at Hiroshima and 10 times the cesium that was released at Chernobyl.
Well,
so this is not a pretty
small issue. Is our unwillingness to look in the mirror at ourselves? I mean, the United States is using very similar GE modeled plants, and we have earthquake zone located nuclear plants. We have high population areas. We've never done any kind of effort to have people leave cities quickly as a drill to prepare for evacuation. So we're not prepared. We're not facing reality. We keep on approving these plants that are really beyond their original lifespan. And so if an accident happens, we're going to look back and say, well, of course, it's obvious an accident is going to happen.
Well, in a stunning triumph of complete reality warp, the United States is now trying to cut a deal with Vietnam to give them nuclear plants.
I can't believe that.
The war in Vietnam ended
in
1975.
Vietnam's a key player in the Trans-Pacific Partnership as well. And I think what's happening in Vietnam with the nuclear agreement that we're going to provide, Kerry's all proud that he's going to be providing business to our nuclear companies in Vietnam by providing them with nuclear technology. That is a disaster. Why are we creating, Vietnam has oceans. Vietnam has sun. Vietnam has wind. It doesn't need to go this route. I mean, it could be the model solartopia.
Well, it's all about corporate profits. We know that. I venture to say that TEPCO expects to come out of the Fukushima cleanup with a profit. They'll find a way to make money on it because they're always at the government trough. I love how people scream and yell about poor people who are on welfare and just blink a blind eye and love to give out corporate welfare. We're talking to Kevin Zeese, a man of many, many, many hats. Let's move on, Kevin, from the depressing topic of nuclear, just because we need a break. Let's talk about cannabis. You've been involved with NORML, which National Organization for, what is it, RML?
National
what do the RML stand for? I can't remember.
Reform Marijuana Laws.
Reform Marijuana Laws, there you go. And although it should be repealed by now, don't you think?
You know, that was actually a debate at the beginning of Normal, and the founder, Keith Straub, wanted repeal, and Ramsey Clark convinced him reform was more traditional in American political language, and that would be more palatable to people. So that's how it got the name reform, thanks to Ramsey Clark modified Keith's original thinking. I served as their chief counsel when I got out of law school back in 1980, then their executive director. Then I started a group called Drug Policy Alliance, which has moved into become a Drug Policy Foundation, which has become the Drug Policy Alliance, which is the largest drug policy reform group, and I'm still involved in drug issues as a president of Common Sense for Drug Policy. We put out a document called Drug War Facts. It's at drugwarfacts.org, and sometimes printed as well, which is a fantastic resource on understanding the drug issue. We cover about 24 issues, from racism to AIDS to medical marijuana to arrest statistics, health effects. You pick the issue, it's covered in there. And we just provide facts and citations. When the citations have hot links, we provide a link so people can get more details. So it's a great resource, drugwarfacts.org.
Excellent. And so before we leave it entirely, I do want to remind people, we do have a petition up on Fukushima, nukefree.org. Anything you want to follow currently about Fukushima, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org. We passed 100,000 signatures last night on our petition for a global takeover at Fukushima. And do visit it there. Do sign a petition and do pass the links on, please. Kevin, with your work on marijuana, so you joined in 1980, so you're in your 33rd year fighting for marijuana. What do you, marijuana legalization or the reform or the repeal of the marijuana laws, however you want to state it, what do you think of the current trends in the repeal of these marijuana laws in Washington and Colorado and with the medical marijuana? What do you think is happening here?
We've made some really great strides, and it really began with a city, San Francisco, voting for a local initiative that was followed by a state, California, in 1996 for medical marijuana. And then it's gone on since. And in the last election, we had two states, Colorado and Washington, vote for legalization, and they both have various regulatory models. What was really, I think, the great breakthrough this year, and I was somewhat surprised by it, because it's exactly what I recommend. I serve as the Attorney General in the Green Shadow Cabinet. We put a report out advising Obama and Holder on how they should respond to Washington and Colorado. And I was very happy to see they pretty much did what we recommended, which was leave them alone. There are some specific federal interests, you know, making sure that bordering states don't get flooded with marijuana, and focusing on big dealers, trafficking into the state, coming from out of state, those kind of border issues. And so you can solve those federal issues and still allow a state to proceed with a democratic will. And that's the goal, I think. One of the great advantages of the federal system we have is that the states can be laboratories where we can try new policies, and if they work, we can copy them in other states, or we can modify them in the states and improve them. And so this is a great opportunity. We are really finally in a phase where a majority of Americans, about 55%, support legalization throughout the country, the nationwide poll, and in some states it's even higher. I think we'll see probably anywhere from 2 to 5 more states vote for legalization in the next presidential election.
All right, well, Kevin, let's hold it there. We're going to take a short break here with Dana Lyons singing the Rocky Top song. We're talking to Kevin Zeist. We finished with Fukushima, thankfully, for the moment, and we're going to talk about increasingly the trend towards legalization of marijuana. We'll be back after this short break. Dana Lyons, my great buddy, singing the Rocky Top Solartopia song.
Pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home to me.
right. That's my buddy Dana Lyons singing the Solartopia Rocky Top version. Dana's fabulous vegetarian anthem, Cows with Guns, has gone over 2 million views. Mazel tov, Dana. It's fantastic. And people should go look at it if you haven't already. Cows with Guns, my good buddy Dana Lyons. Speaking of which, by the way, the idea of vegetarianism, which just comes up with Dana's song "Cows with Guns," saw a great solution for the dilemma of the Washington Redskins. Come from PETA, the animal rights group, the abomination of a pro football team in our nation's capital being called by such a racist slur, has finally worked its way into the mainstream media, and I'm going to predict they're going to have to change that name very, very soon. Thankfully, the president actually mentioned it finally. And but the best solution of all to the name Washington Redskins was put forth by PETA. They suggested that we don't change the name of the team. We change their mascot from a Native American to a potato, so that the Washington Redskins will be the Washington Redskin Potatoes. I thought that was the greatest solution. Oh, I love that. Someone can come up with something equally creative for the abominable Chief Wahoo of the Cleveland Indians. I'd love to see it. Anyway, we're talking with Kevin Zeese. Kevin, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Kevin has a resume 35 years long. A very, very impressive, stalwart actor who's been with us for a long, long time. We're talking before the break about your days with Normal, a national organization to reform, or as we say now, repeal marijuana laws. And we're celebrating the legalization of pot in Colorado and in Washington State. Now, you say you think a number of states will legalize in 2014. Give us some of the likely suspects and tell us what you think is going to happen.
Yeah, I think it's most likely to happen in the next presidential election, not the midterms. Midterms bring a different kind of crowd out that are more conservative, so the people who have money to put initiatives together prefer to do it in a presidential. And I think the most likely are California, Oregon, Alaska, Montana, Massachusetts, Maine. These are the states that have already kind of moved in the right direction on, led the way in moving on medical marijuana. I think they're also very likely on this issue. Now, I expect we'll probably see, you know, three states in the next presidential election, which will bring us to five. And I think then you'll start to really see some real debate about this issue in the public, and people start looking at the money and the human cost of prohibition and realize it's been an utter failure. It has not solved the marijuana problem. It has not reduced the marijuana problem. It has not kept marijuana from kids. It's everything it's intended to do, it's failed at. And it's been given every opportunity because the government has poured more and more money into prisons and arrests and to forcing people into treatment and, you know, just constant weakening of constitutional protections, allowing more search and seizures, allowing more activity by informants. So the police have been given every opportunity. In fact, they've been successful in making lots of arrests and imprisoning lots of people. But all the goals of marijuana prohibition, protecting kids, you know, protecting abuse, preventing abuse, have failed. And so the question is, what can we do to actually solve the problem or at least deal with marijuana in a way that's serious and not, you know, just a law enforcement waste of money?
Well, of course, you mentioned California being one of the states that might is likely to legalize. I certainly agree with you. I think, by the way, that the last legalization attempt on the ballot actually succeeded, and the vote was stolen. I don't think there's any doubt about that. If you look at what happened last time there was a statewide referendum, it was very close. And, you know, California has, as you mentioned, pioneered medical marijuana. But, you know, I think it actually passed. They went in there. You say marijuana problem. Is there a marijuana problem aside from the fact that it's illegal?
Well, I think the biggest problem is illegality. I think that has the most negative effect on people's life is being arrested and having a criminal record, making employment and everything else more difficult. So I think that's the biggest problem. I think we have another issue is the unregulated nature of it. I'm in favor of people being allowed to grow their own, of course. It is a plant. But if we're going to have a market for it, it should be one that's regulated so you'll know what they're buying. One of the things that's really developed very interestingly in the medical marijuana dispensaries is the incredible labeling and testing that the dispensaries do so that people who buy
for medicinal purposes know what they're getting. They know what kind of THC it has. They know what kind of other cannabinoids that, you know, Delta 9, Delta 8, which has a different medical impact. They know the type of a plant. They, you know, you have so much more information. So a really regulated market would be much safer. And I think you also have problems with the unregulated cultivation in that, you know, it's done in a kind of surreptitious way, obviously. You don't want to get caught. Different kinds of fertilizers are used. Private lands are intruded on. So there's all sorts of issues because of the illegality that make it a problem for environment, a problem for people's health, and a problem for people's awareness. And the final thing I think is important is that once you start to normalize marijuana, you can actually talk about it honestly. I think one of the challenges of drug education is that you're in a marijuana war environment. And so that results in police coming into the schools and saying exaggerated things and having the reverse effect. Rather than, telling people the truth, it actually entices teenagers as a way to, thumb their nose at authority. One of the really interesting things in Holland has been how by allowing the sale of marijuana, they've made marijuana boring for youth. And so it's like not a rebellious opportunity. With illegality, it's a rebellious opportunity. With police coming to schools to teach, it makes the rebellion even more likely. And so people tend to use it, some people tend to use it too young in age. So I think there are some issues about youth issues and how we educate youth about marijuana.
Well, good. I'm glad you mentioned it. I was in Amsterdam 5 years ago and walked around and, you know, there's all this press about marijuana is legal there and blah, 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 everybody smoking it. I didn't see anybody smoking on the street, frankly. And boy, there are a lot of people drinking alcohol. I mean, every street corner in Amsterdam, there's a bar or a beer house or whatever, and you have to, like, find the marijuana bars.
Exactly. I had the same experience. I was in Amsterdam for a legal conference on human rights, and I was walking through the town with a German judge and a federal U.S. district court judge. They wanted to see the marijuana clubs, and so we were walking through town, and we just walked right by a couple of coffee houses, which are where marijuana is sold. You didn't even notice them. You know, it was like they're just part of the retail establishments. It wasn't not a big deal. But then across the street there was a bar and some people got into a fight, you know, two drunks got into a fight. And so it's like, oh my goodness, you can walk by the marijuana shops with no effect, but you can even just walk down the street and see the impact of alcohol. It was a great lesson in reality. And I think one of the things that's really going to be great about, Washington and Colorado passing these laws is you'll now have communities with marijuana shops, and people will get to see that's not a big deal, that it actually fits right fine into the makeup of the community, doesn't undermine it, and in fact will add to the community. And we saw that in Oakland with the medical dispensaries, a neighborhood that was pretty much run down and not being used, turned into Oaksterdam, revitalized by the medical marijuana dispensaries that came there in the various retail outlets that supported that, you know, things like a place where you can get your medical marijuana license, people where you can get hemp clothing, you know, so all sorts of stuff sprung up around that, and it created a whole new neighborhood.
Yeah, I want to talk about it in a minute. An amusing story. I was in Amsterdam with my daughter, and I wanted to get a smoothie, pot houses, the pot cafes are the best places to get smoothies. And I walk in, and it was just a prototypical, exactly what you'd expect. The smell of marijuana in the air, reggae music on, posters of Bob Marley. And I went up and I ordered a smoothie. I waited for about 10 minutes and I came back and the guy was just too stoned to make me a smoothie. I had to leave. I mean, he just couldn't get it done. So, the great thing about, legalization now is that there doesn't seem to be anything of note that's happened in California, in Washington State or Colorado, because of legalization. I saw one amusing story in the New York Times. This guy had a bar in Seattle, and you know, they actually banned gratefully cigarette smoking in bars, and he lost all his business, and so he set up a special room in the bar as a private club where people could smoke cigarettes. And it sustained his business, and you know, he got around the law that way. And then he, when they legalized pot, it was the same deal. You weren't, apparently you're not allowed to, it's not legal to smoke the pot in the bars. So he set up a little private club, and they asked him how it was going. He said it was really going great. And his final quote in the article was very cute. He said, well, you know, these people don't drink much, but they sure do eat a lot. Yeah. So I guess he's making his money on the concession stand, you know. So what are the lessons? Also, I saw a very interesting, I saw a piece on TV. I don't remember the context why it was on, what show it was on. But the police in Washington State did a test on marijuana and affected driving. And here you had the cops who actually gave, you know, in a legal setting, marijuana to three different drivers. And they tested them on a driving range to see how their driving was affected by pot. That's a big issue, really. And it was marginal. They said they drove slower. And but they did not see a sufficient impairment in their abilities to have a tremendous amount of concern. I understand one of the laws in one of the states is very, very restrictive on pot content, cannabis content in the bloodstream, and that this was problematic because, I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you smoke pot, it lingers in your system. And if you've gotten stoned and then a week later you go driving, you can still be above the legal limit. Am I correct on that, Kevin?
Not quite. The state is Washington, and they have a limit for your blood content, not your urine content. And urine is where the marijuana metabolites stay in your system for 10 to 30 days, although the record is something like 66 days, but typically 10 to 30 days. And the blood testing, on the other hand, what's different is they're testing for THC itself, not for the metabolite. And the THC spikes after a couple hours and drops in most situations. But it's a real problem figuring out how to do this. We really have not focused our science on testing for intoxication and impairment and what blood levels would matter. Urine is irrelevant, but blood levels could be helpful, maybe. And so we haven't done the kind of research we need to do that right and have a good marijuana blood test for impairment. And Washington put in their initiative, I think, a mistaken provision which sets a certain limit that above that you fail, below you're safe, and it's not really clear the science supports that. I thought you were going to tell a different story about the Washington situation. They have this annual hemp fest, which draws 150,000 to 200,000 people over a couple of days. And I've been there. I spoke there many times over the years, but I haven't been there in a few years. And this year what they did, the police had a operation that they, in reaction to the new law, they passed out Doritos, little packages of Doritos. And on the Dorito packaging, they had, like, information about the new law, and they recommended that you, not play your music too loud to disturb, don't want to disturb anybody. But you enjoy the music, have a good day, and you know, here's what the law allows and doesn't allow. And so it was a great Operation Dorito they did, handing out 1,000 or so different Dorito, and they got great press on it. They got great press for, you know, doing this kind of positive outreach around the marijuana laws.
Well, of course, I would argue that the Doritos are worse for your health than the marijuana.
Exactly. But, all those GMOs in there.
That's actually very funny. So you didn't mention New York State as a place where you were predicting the legalization of pot. Why would that be?
Well, it doesn't have the initiative process. And so the states that will go first will be the ones that have the voters actually deciding things. If you're stuck with legislators, that's going to be a much slower process. And so I think after we have a two more election rounds, and we'll probably be up over 10 to 12 states by then, have voted for it, and during that time period, you also start to see legislators talking about it, and you'll see these states that passed it succeeding and raising tax revenue, not having any serious health problems or social problems from it, and then you'll start to see places like New York and others go forward with it. New York has not even gone forward with medical marijuana, so it's way behind. Cuomo, I think, finally did something on marijuana decriminalization. Bloomberg finally stopped, you know, holding people in jail overnight when they arrested him for possession. I know the medical cannabis community was really hoping New York would move forward on medicinal marijuana. There was a need there, an opportunity there, but it hasn't happened yet. So it's been very slow. New York did pass a marijuana decrim bill during the decriminalization phase back in the 70s, but, Bloomberg has been terrible and misusing the laws and arresting people and holding them overnight actually started with Giuliani and continued with Bloomberg, this mistreatment of marijuana possession cases, which finally stopped just recently.
Well, good. Of course, Bloomberg wanted to ban, what was it, 18-ounce mega sugar drinks, too.
So. And he also announced this weekend he's going after Banksy, the street artist, who's doing a month-long, as he calls, residency in the New York streets, where he's putting up artwork on buildings, graffiti, people call it, I guess. But Bloomberg last week said he wanted to have him arrested for defacing property. So we'll see. Bloomberg tends to like to arrest people. He has a real fixation with his police powers.
Yeah, well, thankfully he's moving on. I mean, the poor guy will have to retire on his $15 billion pension. Talking with Kevin Zeist, an activist with a resume 30 years long. Kevin, I know you've been focused on the TPP. Margaret talked about it last week, your partner in struggle here. Tell us a bit about this. We've only got 8 minutes or so left, and why you're focused on it and what it means.
This is the really next big fight about corporate power, and it's a really important one because it's a global corporate coup. The TPP is a Trans-Pacific Partnership. It involves 12 nations, Pacific Rim nations. It does not include China. I think it's part of the Asian pivot where the United States is encircling China militarily, with 60% of the Navy moving to the Asian waters. The TPP is the economic blockade of China, and I think it's a disaster. I mean, it's been negotiated now for almost 4 years. It's been negotiated in secret, except for 600 corporate advisors who get to sit on their computer and advise the U.S. Trade Representative on taking out this sentence, adding that phrase, and making it all shaped for corporate power. So it's a very dangerous agreement, and I think it's one we can stop and that we need to stop. We have on a website called Flush the TPP, if you remember Toilet Paper Plus, Flush the Toilet Paper Plus, flushthetpp.org, and we're organizing people to stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We think we can win this. 14 trade agreements have been stopped in the last dozen years. The critical fight right now is Fast Track, which would give Obama the power to sign this treaty before Congress considers it, and then Congress would get a very quick up or down vote with no amendments. If we stop Fast Track, we stop this treaty, because Fast Track will keep the public uninformed. If there's no Fast Track, then Congress will hold hearings, take testimony, people become aware of what's in it, and when people become aware of it, they will not like it. In fact, the U.S. Trade Representative, who just retired, Ron Kirk, negotiated most of the TPP, was asked by the media why it was so secret, and he told the media that it was so secret because if the public knew was in it, it'd be so unpopular it could not become law. So this is going to be a terrible law for our economy. In fact, a economic think tank, the Center for Economic Policy Research, just issued a report about 10 days ago that found two things. One, it would only increase the GDP in the United States by 0.1%. That's one-tenth of 1%. That's about the same as an iPhone coming on the market. It's almost nothing. And second, it would have an impact of continuing the race to the bottom in wages, and 90% of Americans would see their wages go down. That's it. 90% of Americans would see their wages go down because we'll be competing with countries like Vietnam where the minimum wage is 35 cents. So it's a disaster for our workers, disaster for our economy. It's only good for the transnational corporations who will get cheap labor and cheap resources, and it's good for U.S. foreign policy if you agree with the goal of encircling China and rather than working with China. I don't think that's a very smart approach myself. So the TPP can be stopped, and I think we're going to stop it, but we need people to help. And so flushthetpp.org would be a great place for you to get started and learn how they can help to stop this disastrous global corporate coup. And that's what it really is. And it's even though it involves only 12 nations, it has a provision that's called a docking provision, which allows any country to join it after it becomes law. And so countries all over the world can, who want to participate in Asian trade, which is one-third of the trade of the world, can sign on to this treaty. And the one provision that really disturbs me as a lawyer is this provision for trade tribunals. What these are a separate court system, kind of like arbitration, that cannot be reviewed by real courts.
And what happens is if Vietnam were to pass a labor law or an environmental law, and that will cost a corporation some profits, that foreign corporation can sue Vietnam in this trade tribunal for the profits they expected to get. So if an environmental law is going to cost a corporation $20 million in profit, it can sue Vietnam for $20 million. And it goes to this trade tribunal, which is going to be made up of rotating judges who are all corporate lawyers coming from corporations, being a judge, ruling, and then going back to their corporation. So it's a rigged system of tribunal where the corporations will always win and the countries and the people will always lose. So any public interest law on environment, consumer, health, labor, regulation of derivatives, you pick the issue, and it's gonna be challenged in these trade tribunals. And that will mean that we won't see laws written for the public interest because these countries will be afraid of being sued by J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs and Walmart and, you know, all these Monsanto, all these horrible corporations that we all hate will have the power, bigger power, greater power than governments will. And that, to me, is one of the scariest parts of this agreement.
Right, and we've seen the impacts of that with NAFTA and GATT and all the other trade agreements. So what is your strategy to stop this, from the fast-tracking and be overall?
We laid a strategy out on our Splusher TVP site and the About Us page, so we describe what we're going to do and what we're doing. First is raise awareness, because this has been a secret. People don't know about it. People know about it, they won't like it, and they'll stop it. And so our first goal is to raise awareness, and so we've been doing a lot of that and making a lot of progress. We do Twitter storms every Tuesday with our allies. That spreads the word on Twitter, massive numbers of tweets to specific outlets to spread the word, and that's been having a big impact. We have done protests that kind of draw attention to it. One that we did that we're pretty proud of was we went to the U.S. Trade Representative's building in Washington, D.C., and covered their building in massive signs to expose their secret trade agreement. I mean, I'm talking about signs that were, you know, 10 feet by 40 feet and 5 feet by 20 feet and, you know, 10 feet by 30, big signs covering their whole building, exposing their secret trade agreement. And that got into the Washington Post. Some of the pictures have been used in lots of other articles. And so we really, and that got people really excited and got a lot of action.
Good for you, Kevin. Good for you. We're down in our last minute here. We've been with Kevin Zeese. Kevin, real quickly, give our listeners the websites to go to, your fabulous work.
Right.
Marijuana legalization on environment and on the TPP, and we'll sign off with that.
Very good. I appreciate you having me on. By the way, your site, Nuke Free, is a great site. I recommend that highly.
Oh, thank you.
PopularResistance.org is our overall site that covers movement, news, and activism. PopularResistance.org, it's a great site for you. Really enjoy it. And then FlushTheTPP.org is the one that's focused on stopping the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
All right, brother Kevin Zeese, following last week on Margaret Flowers. It's been great to have you on. We will celebrate the legalization of marijuana in every state in the country, and we will move ahead and heal Fukushima. This has been another Soultopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you so much for joining. We're moving ahead here at Progressive Radio, and we hope you're coming with us.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Stay tuned for more cutting-edge viewpoints on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.